Shrink Wrap Radio number 900, economist and author Loretta Napoleoni on techno-capitalism.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Loretta Napoleoni, is an economist, international best-selling author, and investigative journalist. We're going to be discussing her latest book, Techno-Capitalism, The Rise of the New Robber Barons and the Fight for the Common Good. Now, here's the interview. Loretta Napoleoni, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I am so pleased to have you here. I'm just so excited and impressed by your book. It's really such a remarkable job. And I was so impressed by it, actually, that I bought birthday copies for my twin adult sons, both of whom are in industry. One is in banking. The other is a lawyer and a corporate mouthpiece.
Yeah.
You won't appreciate my putting it that way.
But, well, that's great.
I'm really curious
to see what they think of it, because, you know, they're young. So, you know,
me too. I'm looking forward to what they have to say. And, of course, it spoke to me because I've been a technophile for a long time. And originally I had planned to be an electrical engineer, but I didn't follow up on that. And then I saw what was happening with in the computer industry and so on, and I got all excited. And that's ultimately what got me both into market research in the technology sector and into podcasting. So I've been doing this for a long time. And your book just captures so much, both that I've lived through, but didn't fully understand, I have for some time actually been aware of what I would call the dark side of technology. And and your book very forcefully brings that out. So we should just jump into this. Interestingly, congratulations on writing a book that's so readable and so sweeping in its vision. I'm just very impressed by that. So we should jump in right away, and let me ask you, what do you mean by techno-capitalism?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, because the original title of the book was different. It was actually Present Future. And the concept of present future comes often in the book, which is the fact that we live in the present, but we're already in the future because technology moves so quickly. Technological innovation is so fast that we'll never experience anything like that. And the human being has a problem in adapting to this speed of change. But then, you know, we had a discussion about the title, and in reality, the book also described the birth of a new phenomenon, which is, you know, the techno-capitalism. It is, at times, one could say there is an improvement in capitalism, And or you could say, you know, is a degeneration, depending from which point of view you look at it. Now, because, you know, I look at the dark side primarily, the main concept of techno-capitalism is the fact that in the traditional capitalist system, so the Industrial Revolution, you had two factors which are the base of the technological change, and that was capital and labor. Today, you have an additional element, and that is technology, so the machines. So we don't have anymore the kind of equilibrium that we've seen with the traditional capitalism, but we have a different situation.
Yeah, and even though you highlight some of the dangers and the dark side that seems to be emerging, to have emerged and to be increasingly emerging, it's not altogether negative. I have to say that you go to some lengths to highlight the positive possibilities that still might lurk somewhere in the shadows. And so I appreciate that. Your writing is so quotable. Oh, before I go there, you wrote this book during the anxious time of the pandemic, and you generalize it to say that we live in an age of anxiety. And I have to say, the pandemic, I don't believe the pandemic is over. Just yesterday in my local paper, I read a story about locally it's called a family chicken farm, where they had to destroy millions of chickens, millions of eggs, because of bird flu and the fear of bird flu. You know, so this thing has not gone away, and nor has the age of anxiety gone away.
Yeah, I mean, I say this in the introduction of the book, basically, that technology. See, I wanted to make clear to everybody that although there are negative sides of technology, technology is overall, you know, positive. And, you know, for example, I could not have written this book during the pandemic if there was not technology to link up with people, to have interviews, to do the research also. So technology is what could save the planet and also our species. The issue is that this technology at the moment is not at the service of the common good. So goals such as, for example, you know, resolving the problem of climate change, producing energy from alternative sources. But it is the emphasis of the use of technology is about profit making. And the profit making doesn't come from investment into the common good, but it comes into different kind of investment, which are, you know, of course, entertaining, for example, or, you know, marketing. So that is the clear issue of the book. You know, let's look at this technology as a gift, a product of humanity, not as a product of a very small group of people and corporations.
Yeah. Your book is so quotable. There are so many things that that are quote-worthy, and I want to read one quote where you refer to us to this age of anxiety that we're in is the Anthropocene era. And you say that this era is one in which the nature no longer drives change, when instead humanity and its Frankenstein creature, artificial intelligence, are at the helm of the planet. And that was a powerful quote, and there's so many others. And it made me wonder, did you read the science fiction book, The Three-Body Problem?
No, I didn't.
You got to find that. It's out of China. It's written by a Chinese fellow, and he takes such a... And it's also on Netflix. That's where I started with it. And then I started listening to the... It's a three-volume audio book as well. Uh-huh. So And he takes such a long view that he, you know, through both the dark times and the bright times of the human species as it goes out into the solar system and beyond. So I think you would really enjoy it.
I'll get it from audiobooks. Does he talk about this anxiety also, or is he only about a deep space?
He goes through so many. It has such a long scope that there are periods of anxiety, dark times, and so he definitely looks at all of that. And since I haven't come to the end yet, I'm not sure if he ends up with some
if
optimism.
The message is positive or negative, yeah. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things you talk about is the underlying dynamic of supply and demand as one of the driving dynamics. You want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I talk about the supply and demand. Again, you know, we're talking about, you know, techno-capitalism. So the truth is that the market is demanding certain kind of products. And of course, you know, these products are supplied by the techno-capitalists or the tech titans. And again, you know, my emphasis is about the common good. So what is really driving the market? Is the supply or the demand? Now, I think, you know, in the case of technology, technological innovation, it should be very much the supply. So we should offer people products which improve their living conditions, which improve the life of the planet. As an example, alternative energy. I talk about in the book about, you know, the Chinese building a solar plant in the low Earth orbit. Because, I mean, you know, at the end of the book, I talk a lot about space. So what they're doing, they're actually using a technology that will harvest directly from the low Earth orbit, the sun rays, and then will send it down to Earth. So that will be absolutely free of charge if you think about it. So the Chinese, of course, they're doing this for themselves. This is a project related to China. Now, the same technology is used by the U.S. It has been used for several years, actually, by the U.S. to experiment a new weapon, which is, you know, the microwave weapon. This is super science fiction. See what when I talk about live in the present, but you're already in the future. They have been experimenting for the last 3 or 4 years about that. So you ask yourself, you know, why are we doing that? Meaning, you know, if we have this kind of technology, why not using this technology, you know, for, you know, the energy that the planet needs? And then, you know, we could solve lots of problems, including, you know, the transition from, you know, fossil fuel to renewable energy. So that is one of the many aspects I discuss about, you know, supply and demand. Because if you can see, even now, AI also is applied primarily to the weapons, the new weapons, the intelligent weapons. But then, you know, of course, there are so many amazing applications of AI in medicine, for example. But the fact, if you look at the flows of money, the difference between the arm industry and, you know, the various industries which are directed to improve our life is enormous. You know, the bulk of the money are going there in the new warfare system.
Yeah. You know, another thing that you look at is the need for secrecy, privacy versus openness. And that's really where the book starts in a way. And we see that cryptography and so on were very important in the early days of what we think of as this technological revolution that we're living in now. And
So I talk about the cypherpunk, which was a group of tech geeks, I'll call them, in Silicon Valley. And in the 1980s, they were very concerned about the role of the state within the internet. They were afraid that the state was going to use the internet to control people, to spy on people. Now, let's not forget, this is the 1980s. These were people that had been experienced the anti-Vietnam War movement. So they were very, very reluctant to trust the government and the state. So the idea to introduce cryptography was to protect the individual from these spying from the state. The cyberpunk, in reality, had a vision of the internet which was very democratic. So the internet was going to be the great equalizer also. So it was giving opportunity to everybody, to improve themselves also, to make money. Now, it's ironic that this was the vision and the fear was the state, because, today what we have is actually the opposite, that there is a predatory kind of behavior inside the internet from various actors. And the protection really can only come from the state, who actually regulates the internet. Now, we've seen with the EU has introduced legislation several years ago, which were based upon the privacy of the individual. So to provide privacy, because our data are actually the most important resource that we have today on the planet. So if you want to use my data, you need to have my permission. And it's completely the opposite of what the cyberpunk actually believed.
Right, they were fearing the government, but today we're afraid of the big business entities.
Yes, exactly.
That are controlling everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're not spying on us as such, but they are taking our data and using our data to condition ourselves, not only in terms of buying goods, but also, as we've seen with the 2016 election in the US and Brexit, but also to influence our voting decisions. So this is exactly what the cyberpunk didn't want to happen.
Yeah. And another thing that really struck me is that in the book was that a lot of these early pioneers were, they were deep into geeky things in terms of their command of mathematics and their interest in computers, that they would work on their computer projects, hardly without eating and so on. And you talk about the role of Asperger's in the development of some of these values that people like Musk clearly seem to be suffering from Asperger's, and their way of thinking is becoming in some ways our way of thinking because we have to learn to adapt to the machines.
I do talk about that. Of course, the Asperger is a big spectrum that goes, from total autism to, just mild social problems. But what struck me about them, the so-called founders of this technological revolution, is number one, they're all men. They're not women. Now, apparently Asperger is more common in men than in women. They all have a sort of obsession almost with what they're doing. I mean, think about Steve Jobs also, Musk. So these are people that live for the work and nothing else. They all have, you know, social problems. They all have a different, I mean, none of them really has a normal social life or even, you know, family life. But, and also they're all super, super knowledgeable about technology and coding. So Asperger people are very good, a certain kind, of course, of Asperger. Again, you know, we can't generalize, but they're very good with numbers. They're very good with, you know, the way actually a computer system works, which is not doesn't use the logic of our thinking, of human thinking, but, you know, use a completely different system. So this is what coding is all about. So that struck me as something really interesting. And then, of course, we have learned how to deal with this new interaction with the machine. So if you think about, you know, Steve Jobs and what he has produced with Apple, the way, you know, we use the Apple phone, the way we interact, you know, with the internet also, is super logic, but not in a human form. Is logic in a sort of machine form. And but you know, we did. So because we're intelligent and we are adaptable, but in the long run, I wonder, with, you know, the development also of AI, how are we going to change ourselves? And this is also the origin of the anxiety that we have today. I mean, one of the many reasons why we have this constant anxiety, because, you know, we feel almost that we're not leading anymore, but we are led, that we are never on top of it. We're always in need to learn something more, to adapt yeah. more and more. Yes.
Yeah. My age group peers complain about that a lot in our Zoom get-togethers. The book has a hope for the common good, but that presents huge philosophical and political problems, right? Like, who gets to decide what the common good is, and where will we find agreement about the common good?
Yeah, I think you know, one thing that the book actually said, there is a chapter about geography, right, which is very much related to what is the common good, you know, philosophically speaking. So here we are. I mean, mapping has always been an instrument a power of the state, meaning, you know, you project an image of the space, which is very much the image that, that the state has of itself. And of course, it's always inflated. So if you look at the mapping during the British Empire, you know, the British Empire areas was proportionally much, much bigger than the rest of the world. You know, that was an emphasis on how powerful the British Empire was. So we have gone from that to a mapping system, which is done, for example, by Google Map, which is the most used mapping, whereby the space is described around the individual, which is, you know, the blue dot. So the projection is yourself. Now, this may be positive initially because you think about, okay, nobody's conditioning me anymore, but in reality, it's not, because you're still conditioned. The mapping will show landmarks around you which are related to what is important for you. So the algorithm will describe a map, which of course is the same for everybody, but the landmarks will actually, you know, change. So if you are crazy about ice cream, in the landmark there will be places in the area around your dot where there are ice cream shops, because, you know, of course the algorithm knows that this is something that you really enjoy. So this has produced this integration I think, of the concept of society, because, you know, we don't look at space in the same way. We all look at space in a completely different way. Now, this is not a positive phenomenon, because, you know, at the end of the day, it compounds on the solitude that we experience when, you know, we deal with this, you know, virtual life, which is becoming more and more, you know, paramount in our life.
Yeah, I look at the, and I think this is sort of contained in what you're, in your book, is really there's a kind of co-evolution of humanity and culture and of human culture and technology. It's co-evolution. We're both being, it's a reciprocal influence.
Yes, it is. It is a reciprocal influence. I mean, we are driving the technological innovation, absolutely. We're still on top of it. And that's where the common good actually comes into place. So we're still in the age of the Anthropocene, as I say in the quotes that you mentioned. Change is driven by us. It's not anymore driven by nature. If you look at, you know, prehistoric era, nature was our great enemy, because, you know, we were prey of, you know, big animals. We were, you know, absolutely, you know, not knowledgeable about, you know, the weather. So we were afraid. Today it's not like that at all. You know, we are in control. So if we are in control, it's a positive thing. It's not a negative thing. But the issue is that what we're going to do forward, I mean, what is the next step? And the next step at this point necessarily has to be in the interest of the society, in the interest of the multitude, in the interest of the planet. Now, if we don't do that, all of this, as I say at the end of the book, is going to be it's going to push us into dystopia. So the issue, I think, is that people are forgetting what the common good is. I don't know if you have noticed it, but in the last decade, there's been less and less mention. If you listen to politicians, if you listen to the media, there is never, ever that sentence. Although 10 years ago, the common good was one of the main issues that was discussed. So we're losing it. And I find it difficult sometimes to explain to people what the concept is, because people have no concept of it.
Yeah, yeah, that is a real loss. So what do you hope that the impact of your book will be?
Well, that's a very nice question, but difficult to answer. I wrote this book because I wanted to understand what was going on. So this is an educational book for me, because, I mean, I don't write about these things. I generally write about terrorist financing of terrorism. So the dark side, the criminal side, you know, money laundering. But I really wanted to understand what was going on. And I started the book on a positive note, because, you know, I thought, wow, you know, this techno-capitalist, they have done amazing things, meaning they have, you know, created a new world, a parallel world to the world we live in. So, but then as I got deeper and deeper into the analysis, I discover that, yes, they have done amazing things, but these things are not put to the interests of the people. We are exploited by them, because, you know, they mine our data, and we are also conditioned by them, because they use this mining to make us do certain kind of things. I mean, there are segment of this technological revolution, which I think are extremely good for humanity in terms of giving something to the people, like, you know, the Bitcoin, which is a currency completely controlled by the network, so controlled by the people. So we don't have the central banking anymore. We don't have, you know, government conditioning the currency. We don't have, you know, the stock exchange also, you know, manipulating the currency. So I think, you know, there are amazing aspects. Plus, you know, it was a gift, meaning nobody knows who was Satoshi Nakamoto. Was he a man, a woman, a group of people? We don't know. So, I mean, there are aspects which I think have remained true to the original idea of the cyberpunk, that the internet should be the great equalizer and should give power to the people. But the majority of the others... even, you know, AI, if you think about, is not really put at the service. It's not put in the place where it should really be.
I kind of assume that maybe part of your answer about what do you hope the impact of your book will be, that people in government will read it, that it might influence decision-making.
No, I actually wrote the book to educate myself and whoever reads the book. So I didn't even dream. Look, I worked for almost 30 years in government consultancy and in situation that were, you know, absolutely very critical, like, you know, after 9/11. And I can tell you that no matter what you say, they don't listen to you, unless, you know, of course, you are telling them exactly what they think. So, you know, this is, unfortunately, we are very much in a society of the yes men. So, no, I didn't write it about that.
You don't have much hope there.
No, I don't have much hope, but I do believe in people. I mean, I think I do believe that people, by reading the book, will understand exactly what is happening. And maybe, you know, they will do something about that. Maybe that's going to make them more interested in technology, not from the point of view of the simple user, but also from the point of view of, you know, the owner. I mean, we should own our data, for example. I mean, why are we not in full control of our data? We should also be protected from the predatory attitude of some of the social media. There is so much, you know. Also, we should put pressure upon the politician to introduce legislation against, you know, antitrust legislation. I mean, most of these companies, as I describe in the book, are actually in a monopolistic position or in an oligopolistic position. And now they are so rich. I mean, they have so much money that nobody can break into that industry anymore. So they can stop you in many, many ways. One of the most common way is offering people, so startup who produce a new technological innovation, which could, of course, you know, then help them to break into these, you know, the magnificent seven companies at the top of the Standard & Poor's 500. So they actually offer these companies so much money in order to be bought that they can't say no. So that's one of the most common way that they actually, you know, prevent, you know, free competition.
Yeah, and despite the pessimism that you express about government, you were enthusiastic about the controls that have been introduced in Europe.
Concerning
data privacy. So something can be done.
Yes. Oh, a lot can be done. I think, you know, the U.S. government also is changing its attitude. We've seen there have been several steps in order to reduce the power of, you know, these oligopolistic companies. But again, you know, it's a very strong battle because we're talking about companies that actually have more money than the nations. So they make
right. Yeah.
Their wealth right. is bigger than the GDP of an entire nation. And also the other aspect is the global reach. So you can go after companies within the borders of your nation, but you can't go beyond. And they have a global reach. So this is one of the reasons why we know that several of these companies file in Ireland their taxes because, you know, in Ireland, you know, they pay much less than they would pay in the United States. Now, this is legal. It's not illegal, but it is immoral.
Yeah, yeah. At this moment, how optimistic are you? if you on a scale of 0 to 10.
Well, I tell you, I mean, I'm fairly pessimistic. I mean, if you look at what is happening with TikTok, actually,
yes. I think,
yeah. So we have, you know, the U.S. government wanted to get TikTok ownership, which is ByteDance, which is a Chinese company, to sell TikTok to a U.S. company because, you know, they are concerned about the spying of the Chinese government through TikTok of, you know, American users. Now, we're talking about TikTok is mega. I mean, we're talking about 200 million people in the United States who have an account. Then, of course, not everybody is using it, but still, you know, talking about huge, huge number. So the U.S. government has given a sort of ultimatum to TikTok. And then, you know, we read in the newspaper last week that the Biden administration will continue to use TikTok for his campaign. So you see what I mean? On one hand, they're trying to reduce the overwhelming power of these companies and, you know, these apps. But on the other hand, they cannot afford in a campaign, presidential campaign, not to use the app. So who is stronger of the two? Cool.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I have to say that I find optimism really hard to come by myself these days, you know, as I look at everything that's going on. There are promising pockets here and there of creative, artistic people who,
yes,
you know, who really want to increase the common good, and so there are idealistic people in the world, and that's good. I try to be one, but it's hard. It's hard if you follow the news,
yeah,
and so on. And, you know, I come from a humanistic tradition within psychology, which...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and there certainly were philosophers and psychologists who saw some of these negative possibilities looming and tried to alert the culture,
mm-hmm,
and who continue to do so. Is there anything we haven't said here that you were hoping we would cover? Anything else that we should say before we
run off? I think, you know, we covered more or less everything. I thought, you know, maybe we want to say something about space, because that's that part of the book, which is the end of the book, it's actually quite positive because it describes all the different things we can do, but we're talking about the low Earth orbit, which is the immediate area after the atmosphere, where there is still a little bit of gravity. We cannot go into deep space exploration because our body will not withstand it. This is something, of course, that nobody tells us. So when Elon Musk talks about, you know, colonizing Mars, it's not only impossible to colonize Mars, as I have an entire chapter explaining why, you know, it would take millions of years to do that, if we even try. But also we can't go there because the body will not survive. But there is a lot that we can do from the low Earth orbit using actually artificial intelligence and using robots. So that's the positive side. And it's an exhortation to the governments of the planet, because again, you know, who owns the low Earth orbit? You know, the planet. I mean, there is not, is not like the geography of the Earth, but it is a reminder that of the damage that we can do to this, you know, last frontier for humanity. We can reproduce the same thing that we've done on Earth. In fact, you know, we already have a huge problem with debris. If we don't address that issue, and of course we have to do it from the private sector and also from, you know, the public sector. If we don't address that issues, there'll be a day in which, you know, we can't even, you know, get out of Earth, because there will be too many debris. So we are reproducing, we're remaking the same mistake that we made on Earth. And then the other thing is the fact that, again, the investment into the low Earth orbit from the private sector in partnership with, you know, the state is very much in producing a nebula of satellites to increase connectivity on Earth. And again, you know, why doing that? Because so you can get more data and you can use more of this data, you know, to condition our decision. Yeah. So the same problem. While, you know, we could do amazing things, you know, there's a lot of medical research that could take place in zero gravity and produce incredible results, which would cost much more to do it on Earth. We can harvest, as I said at the beginning of the interview, the sun rays. So there's so much we can do. Agriculture also. So that's the positive side, and it's an exhortation to governments. That's where the governments should do something about.
Yeah, well, I applaud you for going into what seems like science fiction arena, really, looking at the possible positive futures, and that was a brave thing to do, and I do think that people need to read your book, and I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my recent interview with my guest, Loretta Napoleoni, as much as I did. She is an economist, an international best-selling author, and investigative journalist. And we discussed her latest book, Techno-Capitalism, The Rise of the New Robber Barons and the Fight for the Common Good. Well, I think that title gives you a sense of the slant of the book, which is pretty much on the negative side, though she does lean over backwards to highlight the positive potentials of technology and their positive uses. If you've been listening to me as an interviewer for some time, you'll be aware that I began as a technophile, but as time went along, I've become aware of the dark side of technology. So if, like me, you're a technophile or were a technophile or are worried about the dark side, you will appreciate this book. In her book, Loretta takes us through such currently relevant topics as the cyberpunks, Bitcoin, the crypto world, non-fungible tokens, the financial meltdown, modern monetary theory, the rise of the tech titans, the end of the nation state, the video game of finance, the assault on Wall Street, the mythology of carbon credits, the model of infinite economic growth, and finally, terraforming and space economics. So you can see she really bit off a whole bunch and provides an excellent contemporary history and the challenges with technology. I think this is an important book for our time, and I recommend it highly to one and all.
Dave, it's Amy Feldman calling here from Melbourne, Australia. I'm calling to let you know that I've just made my first donation to Shrink Wrap Radio after being a committed listener now for about 18 months. I admit I've thought about donating many times. I was inspired to donate tonight after listening to your interview with Dr. Jeff Magnavita. I listened right to the end, and I've noticed that lately I'm listening to your whole outro, so including all of your personal reflections, your calls to action, and your sharing of other people's voicemails and emails, etc. So, yeah, I'll admit I used to probably stop at your personal reflections. So I noticed this change, and I thought about it, and I realized that I think it's because I'm starting to feel like I know you on a personal level from having listened to so many shows. Well, not only did I want to show you my gratitude for your show by donating, but I thought it was worth sharing that. And I think it really reflects your personal style of interviewing, because I often feel like I'm sitting in the lounge room with the two of you, and I'm quite often tempted to chime in myself. Also, in your last interview, one of Dr. Jeff Magnavita's words of advice for new clinicians was to kind of be aware of that temptation to kind of grab onto and define oneself by a specific therapeutic kind of framework early on. And he really suggested practice staying open-minded and interested in many ways of working. I've been working as a psychologist now for about 4 months in a specialized therapeutic setting, practicing DBT. So this was really relevant to me. So while I'm, you know, fully immersed in my work, listening to Shrink Wrap is definitely one of the ways that I'm able to do this. It definitely keeps me feeling informed, engaged, and really motivated and inspired to keep learning and challenging myself. So, Dr. Dave, thank you so much for this awesome podcast and for your generosity. And it's true, it feels really good to donate. So thanks again, and I will keep listening. Bye.
Thank you, Amy Feldman, there in Melbourne, Australia. I'm glad that you found the show to be expanding for your career options and your discovery that becoming a donor really does feel good. Thanks for being a longtime listener, and also thank you for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to my guest, Loretta Napoleoni, author of the book Techno-Capitalism, The Rise of the New Robber Barons and the Fight for the Common Good, for writing such an engaging and important book. Next week, my guests will be psychologist David Stone, PhD, and psychiatrist Dr. Matt Keene, MD, on the psychological value of playing board games. I hope you will join us then. Until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.